Thanks everyone for joining us today. This is the August forecast episode for the Astrology Podcast. This is actually episode 118 of the Astrology Podcast, which you can listen to and find out more information about at theastrologypodcast.com. Today we're live streaming the episode to Facebook through my page on Facebook. So just do a search for my name, Chris Brennan, if you're listening to this, and you'll be able to see the live stream and all the comments that went along with this episode. If you feel like it, please share the link to the live stream to let more people know that we're doing it today, since it's sort of something new that we're testing out, and we're going to see how it works. So joining me today is Austin Kopic and Kelly Surtees. How's it going, guys?
Hey,
pretty good. Going very well.
Awesome. And here's the link for both of you to the live stream if you want to share it on your pages.
Excellent. I was just trying to find that.
Shared.
All right. So this is our second experiment with doing a live stream on Facebook in order to talk about the monthly forecast for August of 2017. And we've been building up to it for almost, it feels like a year now, but we finally reached the month of the eclipse, right?
Yes, finally.
Finally.
Yeah, it's the must-see TV of this year's astrology.
Right. This is like astrologers' sort of Super Bowl is the eclipse in August. So we'll talk a little bit about that. We will catch up a little bit on what you guys have been up to over the past month. Also got some book giveaways. There's a couple of new books that I was going to give away to patrons of the show today who are supporters of the Astrology Podcast. So let's go ahead and jump into things. So first off, what have you guys been up to or what do you guys have coming up? Do you have any classes or other things that you're getting ready to do?
Well, as Austin said, it's must see TV month. I will be in San Diego in August, the weekend before the eclipse, teaching through the San Diego Astrology Society. And then my next online class, which is on chart interpretation and aspects, starts on the 21st of August. Just looking at my wall calendar. What about you, Austin?
Oh, let's see. Now that I think about it, I guess I'm on the Holes to Heavens podcast talking about the eclipses tomorrow. I just checked my calendar and I guess I'm doing that tomorrow. I am teaching a class for Adam Ellenboss on Monday, the 31st of July, about starting to integrate fixed stars into your astrology. And so it's some ways of thinking about fixed stars. And then we're just going to pick a couple that whose effects are very dramatic and which, you know, will change the way you see, you know, 26 degrees of Taurus, right? And you know what I'm talking about.
As soon as you say dramatic fixed stars, you know, there is always one that comes to mind.
Indeed. And let's see, I'm also, later in August, I'll be teaching a 4-week module dealing with the entire layer cake of traditional dignity. So we'll go, you know, we'll go beyond rulership and exaltation, look at triplicity, bounds, decans, et cetera, et cetera. And not only will I lay out that structure, but try to make it usable rather than simply cathedral-esque. Because it's one thing to, you know, it's one thing to have memorized those things. It's another thing to be able to apply it in your work. And I'm the guest for the Association for Young Astrologers August talk. We're going to talk about eclipses. And I specifically requested that that discussion be hosted in between the eclipses. So I kind of wanted everybody to already be in the middle of it. There's a lot of sort of pre-game eclipse stuff like we're doing here and like I'm going to do and probably all of y'all are going to do in other ways. But I also wanted to take the opportunity to have a discussion once we're in it, right? And like once in between those two lineations. And so that's in the middle of August. I don't remember the date, but just check the Association for Young Astrologers page. I'm sure they'll be promoting it. And that is free. And that's more of a back and forth than it is a me monologuing.
Yeah, that's a really great program and format that they got going there. So that's at youngastrologers.org.
Mm-hmm. And they're very active on Facebook. So if you're on Facebook, you can follow the page. And there are a lot of great updates they've been putting out. And it'll be fun for me because I've you know, I, like yourself, Chris, was the president of the Association for Young Astrologers, but
who wasn't the president of the Association for Young Astrologers at this point?
Yeah, right.
Oh, listen to the two of you.
No, but you know, we did an official handoff. God, it's closer to a year than 6 months at this point. And Leah's been doing an amazing job, and so it'll be fun to kind of come back to the next incarnation of the AYA.
Sure, definitely.
It should be fun for everybody else too, but I have a special relationship with it. So.
Yeah, definitely. And Kelly, you actually recently participated in a webinar on the eclipse, didn't you?
I did, yes, with Demetra George and Lynn Bell. So we recorded that through Astrology University last weekend. So that was amazing just to be able to be with those women who obviously know so much about astrology in general. But it was wonderful. They both had really interesting ideas, and I was able to, you know, contribute a bit there as well. So that was fascinating, actually. You know, because you think you have your own perspective and your own research and your own ideas, but of course, being able to collaborate and get other people's input or other people's take is exceptional. So I'm excited for us three to talk today about the eclipse, which I'm sure will be a dominant theme in our podcast.
Awesome. Okay. And let's see, other news to get out of the way. In terms of myself, I've been working on producing, you know, the podcast, and this is the final episode of July. And also starting to crank out some videos on my new YouTube channel, which is at youtube.com/theastrologyschool. And I just released one today titled Top 10 Astrology Books for Beginners. So I'm actually excited about that. And I'm trying to learn some new sort of video techniques in terms of putting those together and making good sort of quality productions. So people should check it out and let me know what you think. And then finally, we're almost at the end of the month. So the promo code the 10% discount on my online course in Hellenistic astrology that I mentioned last month is over at the end of this month. So if you want to take advantage of that, you can get a 10% discount by using the promo code astrologypodcast. So just one word with no space, just astrologypodcast on my website at theastrologyschool.com to get a 10% discount on the Hellenistic course. And we're getting ready to do a webinar on Saturday where we're actually going to read through the text of Vedius Valens and some specific techniques that he used from book 2 of the anthology. So I'm actually really excited about that. Any other news and announcements to get out of the way before we get started? Oh, right. We had a book giveaway. So every month we give away two books to patrons of the Astrology Podcast who support the show through the $5 and $10 tiers. And the two books that I wanted to highlight this month, one is a book on Indian astrology titled Light on Life, An Introduction to the Astrology of India. And this is actually really one of my favorite intro to Vedic astrology books. And that's why I wanted to recommend it, since I've had a few Vedic astrologers on the show over the past couple of months. And people have asked me, what's a good comprehensive intro to Vedic astrology book? And I think this is one of the one that's on many people's lists. Have you guys read this one?
Yep. That's one of my favorite intro books to Vedic astrology too.
Yeah.
I haven't read it, but I'm going to check it out actually.
It's super comprehensive while being relatively concise. It's like 400 pages, but it's packed with a lot of information. So I'm going to give that away to one lucky winner of the drawing on Patreon. The second book I wanted to give away, I just found recently. It's titled In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses by Anthony Avini. So Anthony Avini is actually an academic. He's not an astrologer, but he focuses on the history of science, and he's done some amazing work on the history of astronomy and wrote a great book a few years ago about the 2012 phenomenon and like actually presenting the evidence of what survives from Mesopotamian or Mesoamerican astrology, and sort of gave a very sober sort of analysis of the whole 2012 thing before it occurred. So that was a great book, and I'm excited about this one just because it focuses on the history and the astronomy and the astrology of eclipses. So I'll give away a copy of that later today to one lucky patron of the show. And the only other thing I wanted to mention in terms of books is, Austin, you recommended another book on Vedic astrology to me recently that I actually picked up. And I actually got the 2-volume set, and it's actually really good. It was a great recommendation. So I want to make a pitch for it here, which is it's titled The Science of Light by Freedom Tobias Cole. And it's like this 2-volume set on, it's titled, the subtitle is The Foundations of Vedic Astrology. So Austin, you've actually read it, but how did you come across this book?
I was introduced to freedom by a mutual friend like 4 years ago. I had spoken at the Esoteric Book Conference. And then the year after, Freedom spoke at the Esoteric Book Conference, and the organizer was like, "Hey, you guys should talk. You both know a lot about astrology." And we did a little bit then, and we sort of caught up recently. And I've also sort of, in a strangely coincidental manner, been really into Vedic astrology the last 2 months. And so your podcasts have been perfectly timed. And so I've just been digging through Freedom's work. I think, I know he's finishing his PhD in Sanskrit right now, which means he's very busy, but I think he would make an awesome guest on the podcast if he's interested and you're interested.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in having him on sometime, just because this is basically... one of the things I like that he did is he broke it up into two volumes. So it's like volume one and volume two. And that's honestly what I should have done with my Hellenistic book and what many wise people recommended over the years, that I should break it up into two volumes. Instead, I made it one huge 700-page book. But I actually like the layout of what he did here. And I sort of see the ghost of like what two-volume set I could have written at some point, but coming from the Vedic perspective.
You can always do another edition of your book.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Well, we'll see what
happens. These things have been done. I'm just saying, you know, Ben Dykes released all of Banati as a 13-inch thick single volume, and then cut it up into the books. Cut it up later. These things are possible.
That and 20 other books, because Ben is literally a machine like the Terminator who's been sent back in time in order to translate all of the ancient astrological texts that survive in our time to, I don't know, either save humanity or just stop astrologers from being able to read any other books for the next foreseeable future, I think.
Right.
Right. Okay. So I think
can I make one quick comment about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I just want to say it's going to take us a while to integrate everything that's now available to us. Like, we have, we've learned so much about the past in the last 20 years, but as you pointed out, there's so much more. And, you know, it's sort of like, I don't know, you know, we have 30,000 tons of Miracle-Gro to sprinkle on astrology. And that is both difficult, but it's very exciting for where we're going to be in 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that recently because there are so many new books that came out, and I'm about to interview Ben later this next month about his new translation of Theophilus. So he's got another translation out. And there's this sort of question at this point, which is like, how do you integrate and reconcile all of these different traditions? Not just, you know, Western tradition, even in and of itself has so much, but then you have the Vedic tradition and so much going on there. If you wanted to, I'm starting to see some great scholarship, and I recently picked up a book on Chinese astrology, and it turned out that Dorotheus and some Western texts were actually transmitted to China and translated into Chinese there and made it as far, I think, as possibly Japan. So there's that. And then there's also this question we've been dealing with this month on the podcast, which is how do you reconcile really different approaches? And you know, previously we did an episode on the tropical and sidereal zodiac issue, and it was with Kenneth Miller and Nick Dagan Best, and it was more about like reconciling those different approaches or seeing them as different, but maybe useful in their own right. Whereas this month I've talked to two specialists who were more like trying to find what the correct approach is, and had very, you know, arguments that they made for one approach or another and why that works best for them and why it makes the most sense to them. So it sort of raised this question now, which is how do you know when to attempt to reconcile or see things as, you know, two different approaches that are still equally valid versus when do you decide that one approach actually does work better or is more objectively valid in some sense for you? Where do you guys come down on that? I mean, what do you think about that, Kelly, or how have you dealt with that in your practice?
Look, it's a great question, I think, and it is something that we're all going to be dealing with more and more. The biggest thing for me that I could relate to personally is the shift from the Placidus quadrant based house system to the whole sign system. And it reminds me of that quote of like, when you know better, you do better. Not that one is wrong, or, you know, better might not be the right word in the context of astrology, but I think for me personally, as my own philosophy of astrology evolves and my understanding of the philosophies behind astrology evolves, that's prompting shifts or adjustments in practice based on what seems to really resonate with the heart of the technique. So it's a little abstract, and it is very personal because, of course, we all resonate with different pieces of the philosophy individually, but I think it's sort of making it congruent so that the technique you're practicing represents the context or the perspective in which you hold the astrology that you're really connected to.
Sure. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
How do you guys handle that?
Well, so obviously, or I would say on a case-by-case basis, right, there are some parallels between whole sign versus quadrant style division house-wise. There's some parallels between that that debate or issue and the zodiac issue, but there are also ways that those are different questions. And I guess, and I would say that I'm trying not to take a blanket approach, but to try to approach each issue on its own. And to what's been particularly useful for me lately is to try to understand what are we doing when we create a sidereal zodiac? And so what might that be good for? And that's, of course, informed both by its internal logic as well as what people have used it for. What is a tropical zodiac? Where does that come from? What might that be good for? Et cetera, et cetera. Just trying to say it's when you look at the sky and time, it doesn't just give you one calendar. It depends on which things you're watching relative to each other. And so I'm like, okay, what is the decision to do time this way mean? What is it anchored to in the world? And then what does that clock time? Right, which is a question that astrologers are always asking about everything. So, I would say that's kind of where I'm at with it right now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that I've been noticing in some of the discussions that's difficult is that astrologers are torn between two different impulses. One of them is this sort of, as the world becomes more interconnected and as cultures become more interconnected, there's this impulse to see astrology as an extension of culture, and therefore to want to embrace, all the different approaches as all being like equally valid, but just like different things, like different languages is the analogy that's often made. And so in that sense, astrologers often want to say, all approaches work or all approaches are valid, but they're just different frames of reference or different reference systems or like different languages. And you can't say that one language is wrong and another is right. Even if some languages might be more effective in doing certain things or might more commonly be used for certain things. But then there's this other impulse, which is using astrology as maybe a science isn't the correct word, but using astrology as a tool in order to accomplish certain things or in order to figure out certain information, either about the present or the past or the future. And astrologers naturally will gradually develop certain techniques that they think are more effective or work better for them in their own practice. And as a result of that, they're making a sort of judgment call, or they are making distinctions about, what works better for them or what they think is more objectively true in some sense or subjectively true. And so balancing those two impulses in this new sort of astrology world that we're finding ourselves in the early 21st century, where there's so many different approaches, it seems like that's going to be one of the main challenges for astrologers going forward over the next few decades, is knowing when to go one way or another or figuring out how to balance those two impulses.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So luckily for us, we're all happen to find ourselves on the same page and largely use the same approach. So I think that's one of the things that makes things a little bit easier in terms of us doing this podcast and the perspective that we're kind of sharing with people for these forecast episodes. But it's an interesting thing to think about, and I'd love to hear some comments from people if they feel like sharing, what their experience is with that and how they reconcile those two different approaches or issues. So why don't we jump into the forecast episode now that we're a few minutes into this and we got our introductory remarks out of the way? What are the, should we go by like the top major things happening in August, or should we just do it chronologically from the first week of August?
I'm open either way. I'm pretty flexible. Austin, do you have a strong preference?
No, I know last month I had a very strong thing. I was like, I'm getting downloads here and I needed to just get it out. I would say there are too many things going on when I look at August, and it has yet to coalesce into one image for me that I could share. What I was going to ask earlier is, Kelly, what was the most interesting, or what comes to mind out of what arose from your trialogue with Demetra and Lynn? I wonder if there's any particular gems you think might be a nice conversation starter, because August, this conversation is going to end up being about eclipses.
Correct. I'm like, right. We can try and talk about other things this month, but we're really going to be talking just about the eclipse.
Pretend the elephant in the room isn't there.
Yeah. Ah, right. Gosh. Okay. So there was a couple of references to the Saros series that this eclipse belongs to. And the last times that it has happened, which off the top of my head, correct me if I'm wrong, I think were 99 and 81. And the links to Clinton's impeachment and the attempted assassination of Reagan. So there were some interesting points. Lynn Bell made those points. And then Demetra made some wonderful connections with the asteroids, which I can't remember a lot of the specifics, but like a Russia asteroid and a couple of other really interesting pieces. Demetra commented on Trump's solar return for this year, having Jupiter conjunct the ascendant. Oh. Almost that being a little bit like a get out of jail free card for him, potentially. We all talked about the connection to, well, not maybe not all, but I know Demetra and I referenced the Saturn station, which is exactly conjunct Trump's moon in the fifth house, and the connection to his eldest son or one of his sons now being caught up in this along with his son-in-law, so the children issue. And I had made the point about Trump being in a 12th house perfection year, being ruled by the moon, which is having that Saturn station on. I personally was quite concerned about his, like I talked about the 12th house as being, you know, illnesses of the soul or the spirit or the mind, contrast to the 6th house, which is illnesses potentially of the body or more specifically in the tangible. So that stress piece. So they were some of the bigger points that stuck with me. Boston, yeah.
Yeah, so I just wanted, if I'm remembering Trump's chart correctly, if we're doing Leo rising, 12th house Cancer, what's interesting is he does have the ruler of the 6th, Capricorn, in the 12th.
Correct, so Saturn is there, yes.
So there's not only the, diseases of the psyche, but also the body.
The body
play in that perfection year.
Well, and that's what I thought too. I hadn't picked up on that piece, but you're right. But even just having the moon receiving that station of Saturn, because the moon has more to do with the body, or I see that showing up with physical problems. So I was like, the both are going on there. But this looks like someone really in the grind, like under pressure.
Well, and where that showed up recently actually was. It's the ruler of the 12th activated this year as the Lord of the Year, and natally it's in the fifth house of children. And
yes,
that was like the big thing over the past month has just been, you know, that whole email exchange that his son had and the sort of implications of that, and whether that in of itself would drag sort of Trump down or would become problematic or, you know, annoying or whatever for him.
Absolutely. And so that we talked about, and then, yeah, Demetra mentioned towards the very end of the presentation about the Jupiter ascendant and the solar return, and I had made the point, based on our discussions, guys, you know how we talked about after the election, and one of us sort of made that point that Trump has Regulus on his ascendant, if we use that 1054 time, and, you know, my interpretation of that is it's literally a Trump card, and if you're going to defeat someone who has that star in such a prominent place, you need an equal amount of strength, or you need something equivalent, and that it was sort of like, okay, how do we, you know, how does he come down if he's got this great gift? And then Demetra had commented about the Jupiter on the ascendant, the solar return, as like a get out of jail free card. So
one thing about Regulus is I haven't studied this with a particular focus, but Bernadette Brady basically makes the case that it's up to Regulus people to defeat themselves.
Right. Yeah. And you have to be very aware of things like the negative emotions of jealousy or, you know, ego getting away with you, or if you get caught in a thing about revenge, yeah, that will bring you down. The revenge for those royal stars will be the downfall. So that's true, actually, Austin. Maybe we just need for him to get into a position where he tries to go out and take revenge against a particular person or organization and have that be his own downfall, potentially.
What's the nature of Regulus again, Austin? Is it like Mars and Jupiter, according to Ptolemy?
I'm not a huge fan of that planets stars thing. I think it's rough. It's not useless, but I think it's a crooked,
it's broad road. And crude.
It's crude, right? I would say that, you know, Regulus is super solar. In terms of being able to be seen and to be popular, you know, it's sort of like, it's fame steroids.
And it is, it's about fame and success, but it's not necessarily about happiness or satisfaction.
Right.
Hmm. Okay. And in terms of
Ptolemy says Mars and Jupiter. Yeah.
That makes sense. It's aggressive, but it's also, you know, often self-celebratory, although one could encounter Regulus if it were conjunct a planet that ruled the seventh, then a person would be drawn to that in a partner, you know. But for him, it's on the ascendant, so.
Sure. And so this becomes relevant because the eclipse this month is taking place in Leo, and it's taking place in Trump's first whole sign house. And one of the things that we actually learned during the Obama presidency that was actually pretty impressive when it happened is, you know, Ptolemy makes this statement. So it's a very old doctrine that the chart of a leader of a country becomes almost like a proxy for the chart of the country in general for the period that they're in control or in power. And so there has been this sort of lingering question for the past year or so, which is, you know, does his chart then and things that happen to it have a ripple effect across the country if it starts getting hit by major transits or in this case, the eclipse that takes place this month? So we do know. And then aside from that, we know that everyone's calling this, you know, quote unquote, the Great American Eclipse. I'm not sure who came up with that, but it seems to become more common over the past few months because it's actually crossing the entire continental United States, essentially, right? Starting in the Pacific Northwest and then going over all the way to the East Coast, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And the other piece around, like, the point you're making, Chris, I completely agree with the idea that the leader of a country's, their chart sort of becomes a pseudo chart for the country itself. Tycho Brahe commented, you know, Danish court astrologer in the 16th century off the top of my head, he commented about how he thinks that kings and princes are more affected by eclipses because the sun and moon are like princes among the planets. So the idea of like how will the eclipse affect us, I think it's incredibly significant when we have a leader of a country, not only when a leader of a country's chart is being triggered by the eclipse, but when that person happens to be leading a country where the eclipse is having the largest swath of visible totality, because that also highlights the geographical area where these eclipse events come to pass.
Yeah, agree totally. I wanted to back up to one of the earlier points that you shared, Kelly, which is what happens when we look at the last time there's eclipse, solar eclipse on the North Node in Leo and the time before that, et cetera, right? And that brings us to the attempt to impeach Bill Clinton and to the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. And so we have the leaders of country, you know, the leaders of this country obviously going through a rough time.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, whether if we leave speculating on the outcome aside for a second, Donald Trump is certainly going through a rough time and it's probably not going to get easier during August. And, you know, it's also worth remembering that in the declaration chart for the United States, the North Node's in Leo, right? This is the cycle for the United States. And, you know, one of the ways that I've been trying to think about this without becoming obsessed about exactly what will happen to one person is that this is, you know, this is a crisis of leadership cycle for the United States, right? And this isn't the first crisis of leadership that we've ever had and will not be the last. but that we, you know, we can, again, I think it's useful to hold a little bit wider frame and then think about particulars within that, because I do feel like Donald Trump does appear to be an attention vortex and participated in many conversations that have gotten derailed where everybody just wants to focus on that. And it's certainly hard not to want to speculate about that. But there's also the meaning, the greater meaning. Like you said, this is the country as a whole. This series has a lot to do with the country as a whole. And Kelly, the point you made about not only do eclipses perhaps affect leaders more, but this eclipse is more visible in the United States than any we've had for a very long time. And it's conjoined the current president's ascendant. Worth noting that, you know, Bill Clinton had several planets in Leo, right?
This eclipse is on Clinton's sun.
Right. And so.
Yeah. Within as close degree as it is on Trump's ascendant.
Yeah. We like our Leo heavy presidents in the United States. We also like presidents with things in early Cancer.
Choleric dominant. I mean, and you make a good point, Austin, the idea of the concept or the symbolism of a solar eclipse is the sun, the main planet to do with leadership or kings or figureheads, is eclipsed. The light is blocked and darkened by the moon. And so that is significant, I think, for leaders in general. And then especially so given that this is a solar eclipse in Leo, which is a sign of, you know, kings in general. So, yeah, you're right. If we just take a step back out and forget about the specific, not forget, but just to broaden our view, this is very much an eclipse that I think even maybe there's a reference in some of the older literature around specifically eclipses in Leo having issues with leaders in general.
Yeah, well, yeah, and again, the United States is the focal point of this eclipse, but there's a pretty much a crisis in leadership in the world in general. Mm-hmm.
Britain has just had an issue there where their sitting prime minister decided to call an election early and has lost her majority, let alone what else is happening with other European leaders.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, you know, for example, what's going on in the Philippines, where you have a leader whose policies are very clear or, much more brutal than the norm, but is very popular. There's a leadership, there are a variety of leadership changes, happening all over the world, like the kind of leaders we had since the beginning of since the post Cold War era sort of settled. You know, you get a couple varieties, and I feel like the species of leadership are in the process of mutating right now globally. You know, everybody reacts to the present in a different way, and our present is very different. You know, like the Uranus Pluto squares did a great job of disrupting what we'd been doing, what a lot of countries, you know, had been doing for better or worse for a couple decades. And that we're at this sort of dawn of we're pre-dawn of a different era. And the solar eclipse in Leo, the solar eclipses, because there will be more, how should we say, it speaks to that and points to that aspect of the present, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I don't want to get too caught up on politics, you know, too much, even though that's obviously one of the most relevant and pressing things and things that most people point to with this eclipse, just because it's so clear in terms of how it shows up in, you know, the leader of the US's chart. And so one of the things about eclipses that I wanted to talk about is there's a sort of alteration, or there's two different approaches oftentimes, where on the one hand, there's been a sort of traditional notion of eclipses as sort of like harbingers of doom and like difficult things. And then there's this other sort of approach of eclipses sometimes being more like important markers in time that are signifying something important happening, but not necessarily being like the end of the world or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's kind of an important point to talk about and maybe focus on in terms of how this might relate to some people personally, especially if it's falling in a prominent part of their chart, or, you know, if the person has that eclipse somehow activated in a notable way as like a Time Lord or something like that this year, then they might expect something like that. So I know one thing that you mentioned earlier in the show, Kelly, is the Saros cycle. And I was wondering, you know, how could that be relevant in terms of personal prediction in terms of eclipses?
Yeah, so the Saros cycle works on, I always get confused whether it's 18 or 19 years. I think the Saros cycle is 18 years, which is different from the Metonic cycle, which is 19 years. So the idea is that the Saros cycle, all eclipses belong to one Saros series or another, which is like a family or a group of eclipses. And these groups of eclipses start as tiny partial eclipses at either at the north or south node and then move up or down the globe, and they become strongest the nearest they are to the middle band of the globe. And part of what makes this eclipse coming up in August 2017 so dramatic is that it is part of a Saros series. The Saros series takes about 1,300 years, and this one is about 650 years old. So we're right in the middle band. So we're in that period where the eclipses in this Saros series are coming through in their most dramatic or total form. So if you're looking in your own chart, there's two ways to really work with it. You can either work with it on the 18-year cycle and think about the themes of this eclipse and how the eclipse now triggers your chart compared to how it did 18 years ago. So the thing to keep in mind is that the eclipse belonging to the Saros series from 18 years ago won't have been at the exact same degree in Leo. That you've got to go to the 19-year cycle. So there's a couple of different cycles that you can use that sometimes does trip people up with the eclipses. I think personally, the energy of this eclipse, if we step back from the global, this is a new moon, north node eclipse conjunct Mars. There's a lot of energy about pushing forward. So if this eclipse is hitting a point like an angle or a planet, like a personal planet or the sun and moon in your chart, it's very much about this pushing forward, breaking from the past. The sensitive degrees, we've got the node at 24 Leo and then the sun and moon conjunct, the lunation itself or the eclipse at 28 Leo. Anything within 3-degree orb, I think of either of those points really. And so if this eclipse is directly hitting your chart, that sort of Mars, it's a huge emphasis of energy. Have you guys thought about it from that perspective, like the new moon, north node, Mars pushing forward and what that might mean for people?
Yeah, I mean, that's crucial here just because it's so close to, you know, that lineup of with Mars. It's kind of unique in terms of eclipses go, having another planet so close to it like that. I was actually thinking, I haven't looked into this. I'm sure it's probably mentioned in like an astronomy article, but will we actually be, if you're like in like Casper, Wyoming, or where it's dark enough, will you actually be able to see Mars once it gets dark enough out, even though it's in the middle of the day? Or how will that? Because, you know,
that comment came up in the eclipse panel that I think Lynn might have suggested that we will actually be able to glimpse Mars if the conditions are right. It's right on that 8-degree mark of being too close to the sun. But because the sun is dark.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be pretty wild.
Right? Mercury as well, for sure. So to be able to see Mars and Mercury in the middle of the day, I mean, even the symbolism of that the solar force is occluded and there are other light forces or other symbols or other types of people, for instance, that come forward or step into that void, I think that's worth reflecting on.
Yeah, that connects to one of the ways that I think about eclipses based on some of the experiences that I've had doing various, let's call them meditative experiments during past eclipses. And at some
reading between the lines. I love it, Austin.
So I was doing some stuff on an eclipse last year. And I had this really it felt profound at the time, sort of vision of these two circles, which are usually out of alignment. You could see them, these two circles, which are usually out of alignment, clicking together and then opening a door. Let me see how to get into this. Okay, so imagine one door leads from phenomenal reality from, like, you know, solid, what seems real reality out into what is invisible or spiritual. And that's one doorway, right? That's one direction. And then you have another doorway, which leads from the invisible to the visible, right? So stuff wants to go from the invisible into the world of, you know, of visibility, into what we consider real. And then some things want to leave the world of visibility and go back into invisible. The simplest, the like very simplest version of this would be the way that a soul comes into this world and then leaves this world, right? But it's not confined to those dynamics. The vision that I had was of those doors usually being blocked, and that the eclipse, like when during the eclipse, the two doors sort of click together and then both opened, and you have everything that's waiting to get in able to get in, and everything that's ready to go out can go out. And my experience of that was on the first of two eclipses, and it kind of felt like that door was just open for the next several weeks and didn't close until well after the second one. And that if we look at some of the ideas, some of the very core ideas presented about the nodes in Vedic astrology, you know, both of the nodes are represented as half figures, you know, not unlike our head and tail of the dragon. But if you have Rahu, the north node, he's often seen as not having a lower body. And then Ketu often doesn't have a head. And both of them are explicitly about dealing with the way that the invisible and the visible interact. And that, you know, half of the part that appears to be missing is in the invisible part. And that, you know, and then there's the part you can see, which is the half we can see, which is in the visible part. And that nodes, the nodes and the eclipses that they augur, have to do with these, you know, the snake or dragon winding in and out, winding in and out and almost lacing together the visible and the invisible. And I know I've been ranting for a while. I have one more thing to say. And that is, Chris, you made a point earlier about, are they omens of doom or does it mean something else? One of the things that I see is that eclipses appear to be, in some cases, a fate delivery system, where things that were sort of, in retrospect, where it looks like things that were always going to happen that make deep poetic sense in terms of a person's biography come through.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost as though this is the time where that download or connection or interaction happens, where things that are essential or necessary are happening, maybe on a slightly faster timeline than mm-hmm. one might have expected.
Right. They've been latent for a while. They've been waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I see that a lot in client charts, where sometimes you'll have, because one of the things you noted, of course, Austin, is that this is the first eclipse of a series of eclipses that are going to take place in Leo over the next year or two. And so this is, in some ways, it's not just going to be a singular event, but we're looking at, you know, the starting off point in a series of events, potentially in some instances, or at least with respect to some things. And sometimes for clients, you'll see that show up if it moves into a new house. Like if, you know, wherever Leo is in your chart, you might look at what whole sign house that is. And for some people, those topics are going to become highlighted over the next couple of years. So if that's falling in your 10th house, that might be highlighting the career sector and some really, really critical turning points or a critical series of events that starts taking place at this time. If it falls in your, you know, 4th house, it might pertain to your home and your living situation. If it falls in your 7th house, it might pertain to relationships and maybe the starting or the ending of major relationships, depending on how it's situated. So from a personal standpoint, sometimes a non-mundane standpoint, it can be useful to just look at it as a crucial turning point or signifying a crucial turning point with respect to the topics in the part of the chart that it falls.
Mm-hmm. I would also say we should remember that there are eclipses in Aquarius too. Right. There are no eclipses without polarity, right? Like it's always about a pair of houses or a pair of signs. And this poor partial lunar eclipse isn't getting any love at all.
But it's happening first, isn't it? So So lunar eclipse in Aquarius, I think, what are we, about the 7th of August?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me pull 8th up the,
in Australia.
Let me pull up the chart for that. I'm kind of slacking today on displaying the charts. So here is the chart for the eclipse itself, which is at 28 degrees Leo, correct?
Yes, the solar eclipse at, on August 21st, 22nd in Australia. And as Austin's saying, the idea that it's a pair of houses, because we have the nodes moving through Aquarius and Leo now, and that's the setup or the landscape for eclipses over the next 18 months. Because there are going to be some maybe not so visible in the US eclipses next year, but there are still some pretty exciting eclipses in Aquarius and Leo into 2018.
Yeah. If I'm remembering correctly, there is... Never mind. I'm not going to bring it up because I would need to triple check it. I don't want to open another can of worms.
That notion of polarity, though, that's really important just because that means when an eclipse moves into a new house for you, it's activating not just the topics of that house, but also the topics of the opposing house. And you get like a year and a half or almost 2 year period of just bouncing back and forth between the topics of those two opposing houses becoming sort of lighted up at that point, or lighting up in terms of your life and in terms of your experience of the events surrounding those specific areas of your life. So if it's, you know, first house, seventh house, sometimes that's like self versus others, or sometimes health and relationships. If it's fourth house, 10th house, that might be your home and family and living situation versus your career and reputation. What are some other polarities in those different houses that might be relevant for individuals, depending on where it falls?
Sixth house, 12th house. So the health, wellness, work, service sort of axis. Did you say third, ninth house?
No.
Learning, travel, ideas, concepts, philosophy, expression. Fifth and 11th. Did you mention that one?
No, that would be good. Like children versus friends or something like that.
Yeah, and I sometimes see that 5th, 11th house as like the axis of pleasure and relaxation. And are you doing more sort of stuff for yourself personally, maybe with children if you have it 5th house? Or are you more focused on friendships, groups, you know, doing things at a leisure or relaxation level but out in the world more? So it will be really interesting for people to think about. And 2nd, 8th, of course, money, resources. Yeah.
What's yours, what's mine, and what's ours?
What exactly? Oh yeah, Austin, you'll be able to tell us about that one.
In the 2nd and the 11th, one of the topics that I've been really more fascinated about over the past few months and seeing it just so vividly sometimes is the idea of the work that you put into things that won't come to fruition until some point in the future. So what you're working on now that has long-term and not necessarily immediate implications, just because both of those houses or planets in both of those houses are actually rising up towards the angular house. So they're building up and sort of setting the foundation for something that may not pay off until later.
That's interesting. I wanted to add about the 5th and the 11th. One of the ways that I see the 5th and the 11th work for people is that the 5th is what you are creating and the 11th is who can see it. And so half of the time, a 5th, 11th set of eclipses will be about letting people see what you've been making, letting people see what you're creating with your life. And then the other version is stop worrying so much about what everybody thinks and just do your thing, depending on where the north and south are.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. So this is the chart. I have the chart up right now for the lunar eclipse that takes place on August 7th. So this is right away the first week of the month. That's one of the major highlights of this month, or of the first part of this month, is we get that lunar eclipse right away in August 7th. And that's tied in with the previous set of eclipses from 6 months earlier, right?
Yes, the February eclipses.
Sort of. The February eclipses were... a little bit of it was the last eclipse in the Pisces Virgo series, but the first in the Leo Aquarius series. And so it was sort of a linkage between two sets. Yeah.
Cause we've had the nodes change signs since we've had the February eclipses.
Right. Yeah. But we still got one in Leo.
We did. We had 22 Leo in February.
And I would recommend looking at what happened then to get an angle on what is probably going to happen at the end of August, but more loudly, right? It's an eclipse in the last decan of Leo. That was lunar. This is solar. This one's stronger, but there will be a connection between those two points in time.
Definitely. And in terms of early stuff, because I do want to go through a little bit chronologically, so we make sure we hit everything at this point. But at the very top of the month in August, we've got a Uranus station in late Aries, right?
Yeah, on the 3rd, I think, at 28 Aries. So this is maybe the second last station in Aries.
Yeah, so we're actually getting ready, getting towards the very end of what is that? It's been like a 7-year transit of Uranus through Aries.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I moved in 2010.
Yeah,
and
May 2010. And then it jumped back to Pisces, and then it entered for keepsies about within a day of Fukushima in 2011.
Okay. And this is one of those things, because we noted at the beginning of the year that there's tons of activity in late fire signs pretty much all year, because you have Saturn in late Sagittarius, you have the nodes going through and other stuff happening, including the eclipse in late Leo, and then you've got this station of Uranus at 28 degrees of Aries, which is interesting because that's trine to the eclipse degree, which will be at 28 degrees of Leo. So that's an interesting precursor in terms of the eclipses coming up, just because that happens right out of the gate at the very beginning of August, on August 3rd, like Kelly said.
Is it the 3rd? 2nd, sorry, maybe. I'm just reading out of the ephemeris, yeah. Okay. But it is early in the month for sure. And you're right, Chris, because around the time of the eclipse, in addition, we are going to have a bit of a fire trine going on with Saturn, Uranus, and Mars. Probably the sun is, so that eclipse is sort of part of the August eclipse is part of that. So that late fire activation is reaching a bit of a peak.
Right, definitely. I mean, this is it's not the end, but it seems like the sort of culminating point of a lot of the fire stuff that we were pointing out in the forecast episode for this year. It all really takes place this month, this summer, where you get so many planets in fire signs, including at one point Mercury. So one of the big issues with Mercury is when we were looking at the electional charts, and when Lisa and I were looking at electional charts for this month, it's like we wanted to use that Mercury in Virgo to create some nice Mercury elections, but we ran into an issue, which is that it's getting ready to station retrograde, of course, and that question of whether you would still want to use and make the focal point of an electional chart a planet that's preparing to turn retrograde. How do you guys feel about that?
I would say it depends on how close. I also am wary of Mercury being moving in towards opposition with Neptune. I find Neptune's aspect to Mercury to be very disruptive in terms of Mercury's priorities.
Yeah, especially Mercury in Virgo, where you're shooting for a much clearer and more grounded and more, you know, sort of detail-oriented Mercury in terms of communication or speaking or research or whatever mercurial type thing you're trying to do. But then if you put Neptune exactly opposite to that, you're literally almost counteracting some of the good things that you're trying to get from that Mercury in Virgo.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Neptune is very hostile to Mercury's significations.
Yeah. I think one helping factor for the Mercury is the support from Venus via sextile, Venus in Cancer. And that sort of builds, it actually peaks a couple of days before the start of the retrograde itself. So I think that's a helpful feature. I don't know how close I would go to the Mercury station if I had to make Mercury the focal point in an election chart. I think I would try and keep a few days away from the station itself. The opposition to Neptune won't perfect or become exact until September, because Mercury will station retrograde at 11 Virgo before it gets to Neptune.
Right. Let me just animate that. So there's Mercury getting to 11 and then stationing by about August 12th or so at 11 degrees of Virgo. So you're right. It doesn't quite perfect, but it gets within, what, I guess, a couple of degrees of that opposition with Neptune.
Yeah. And if you back the chart up a few days, Chris, back to Mercury about 10 maybe 9 degrees, that's when we get the sextile from Venus really coming in quite strongly. So I think that can be a bit helpful.
Yeah, definitely, especially with Venus in the superior position back there in Cancer. So this is probably a good time actually to bring up the electional chart for the month. So let me pull that up. So Lisa Scheim of lisascheim.com did the electional chart for this month and struggled, like I said, a little bit with that Mercury. And it's like wanting to use that Mercury in Virgo, but we ultimately didn't think that any of those elections were worth highlighting as the best election for the month. So what we ended up doing then is going with a kind of safe Cancer rising election at one point when the moon makes it into Cancer. So this election takes place August 18th. It wasn't a very good month for electional charts, honestly. It was a hard month to find really super strong or super ideal ones. So just about every chart.
I would agree.
Yeah, so you've had some issues doing that with clients as well?
Yeah, I have. I was like, oh my gosh, it seems like there should be some, but it's just really tricky. I've suggested September. So when we get to September, there'll be a lot more elections to talk about.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you've got to, there's a difference between like, you know, if you've got several months and you want me to recommend a chart, the best chart I can find in a several month period versus if I need to recommend the best chart I can find in this time frame, it's a much different, you know, sort of litmus test or much different calculus that goes into choosing that sort of chart. So this is one of the best that we could find for this month that we wanted to highlight for August. So it takes place on August 18th, 2017. We have it set for 3:24 a.m. in Denver, Colorado. So you're going to have to get up pretty early or...
Nice and early.
I mean, in my case, in Austin's case, stay up a little bit late.
You guys will be still up, so yeah. That's fine. We'll be
having, yeah, that's not quite bedtime.
That's like dinner time. So it has Cancer rising, and this is using local time. So you should be able to set it for about 3:24, about 3:30 in the morning for most locations. And you just want to adjust the chart so it has about 20 degrees of Cancer rising. So the thing that this chart has going for it is it's a night chart with Cancer rising. The moon is the ruler of the ascendant, and it's placed in Cancer in the first whole sign house in its own sign. So it has both sign-based sort of strength or auspiciousness as well as decent placement by house. If you wanted to, you could even do it a little bit earlier and back the ascendant up so that the moon is exactly conjunct the degree of the ascendant. If you want to make it a little bit more prominent in the chart, or if you want to push it into the first quadrant house, the moon itself is actually just barely separating from a sextile with Mercury, which is probably for the best because otherwise it's applying to a retrograde Mercury, which isn't super, super helpful necessarily. But in this chart, it's actually applying to a square with Jupiter, which is down in the fourth house in Libra, and then eventually to that conjunction with Venus, which is in the first house. And in this chart, we have it right on the degree of the ascendant in a night chart, so that Venus is actually the most positive planet in the chart based on the concept or the principle of sect, which holds that Venus is more positive in a night chart and Jupiter is more positive in day charts. So the challenging planet in this chart, because it's a night chart, is Saturn, which is sort of off in the sixth house, not causing too many problems in terms of the ruler of the ascendant or the moon. We have the Sun and Mars in the second house, not really doing that much. We do have Mercury and Virgo in the third house. It's already retrograde by this point, unfortunately, so it's not super helpful, but it's at least relatively well placed in Virgo in the third whole sign house. And then finally, we have Jupiter angular in the fourth. So this is a chart that really emphasizes both of the benefics by making them both angular and thus kind of drawing out their power in terms of this electional chart. So this is the main election that we wanted to highlight publicly this month. What do you guys think?
I can see why you want to get up at 3:24 because you want to keep Mars. You're looking for a night chart, obviously, to keep Mars in his better self.
Right.
Yeah, I think this is functional if you're awake at 3. It's not functional for me because I'm sleeping.
Yeah, it's funny sometimes with these charts and the like weird times that astrologers end up doing things. And I sort of go back and forth between sometimes like thinking that's really smart and like brilliant and worth it. And other times, like, you know, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm getting up super early and wondering if this is just neurotic to get out of bed that early in order to get an electional chart and then launch it and go back to sleep. But then, you know, as we've discussed many times in the past, you do those other instances where you astrologers will occasionally just say, you know, forget about it, I'm not doing the electional chart. And then you do it under a terrible chart and everything goes awry. And you're sort of reminded in that moment of why, you know, sometimes we do go out of our way to get a good electional chart from time to time.
Yep. I have had both of those experiences.
It is worth it. I agree. Even just to get a nice ascendant ruler and a nice moon aspect. And in this case, they're one and the same. So it would be good. I'm thinking for me personally, it'd be great if I had to schedule something to be published or to be sent out, you know, and then of course you can do that in advance. Yeah.
Right. All right. So yeah, so that's our electional chart for this month. And Lisa and I are actually going to record either later today or tomorrow our full 45-minute auspicious elections podcast, where every month we record a 45-minute episode that's released to patrons of the Astrology Podcast who sign up through our page on Patreon on the $5 or $10 tier, and then they get access to 3 other electional charts that we actually discovered for this month, and then we record a podcast to outline them for patrons. So if you want to find out more information about that, I think you can go to theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe and then go to our page on Patreon and you'll see the other information about the Auspicious Elections podcast. All right, so that's the election for this month. So where are we at in terms of, so we've talked a little bit about the first week of August. What are some of the other major things happening astrologically? I think we're at like the third Jupiter-Saturn or Jupiter-Pluto square, right?
I was just going to bring that up. We have 2 really interesting Jupiter moments this month. One is Jupiter-Pluto, Jupiter square Pluto, and the other is the long delayed completion of the sextile between Jupiter and Saturn.
Okay, yeah. So let me pull that up screen for people that are watching the live stream or that are watching the video version of this, which is the benefit of us starting to do videos. So around August 5th-ish, it looks like we have Jupiter, which is now finally direct. And by this point, it's like cruising through the later parts of Libra, or it's the middle parts of Libra, getting ready to get towards the end of Libra within just a few months. And Jupiter completes its final square with Pluto right around 17 degrees of Libra in Capricorn.
Yes, that's in like the first few days of the month. And then we have the Jupiter sextile Saturn towards the end of the month. But Austin, I had actually forgotten about the Jupiter-Pluto square, so I need to hear what you have to say about this.
Well, I just remember at the end of our last month's recording, somebody was like, are you going to talk about Jupiter-Pluto? And we're like, yeah, we'll do that next month.
Yes, you've got a good memory.
We definitely have to do that.
Totally. Okay, so what do we want to say about this? I'm going to find out when the first hit was to remind myself.
It was Thanksgiving, American Thanksgiving.
November 2016. That's right.
I like that you're looking at your ephemeris, because that's actually demonstrating why I put that on the second. That was my second recommended book for new students of astrology
as an ephemeris. Yeah, you absolutely. I tell my students, you really do, as much as you have great software, which of course we all do, even if Austin has, or who was it that didn't have Solifier?
It was me.
Austin. It was you. Do you have it now?
I told y'all, I said to everyone, I'm going to, like, this is a great deal because Chris had discount code.
The saving was amazing.
I said, I'm going to go do that. And I totally went and did that.
I still have that, by the way. So listeners of the Astrology Podcast can get a 15% discount on Solifier if they use the promo code AP15 with no spaces when they purchase Solifier through the Astrolabe website. Use that promo code and you'll get a 15% discount.
So we had, so this is our third hit. All of these Jupiter square Pluto hits, the first one in November 2016 was at 15, Libra Capricorn.
Okay.
The second one was at 19, Libra Capricorn. The third one now at 17. And the second one was, it looks like late March, early April. I'm like just thinking about this. Austin, are you pre-prepared?
I know what I kind of liked what I wrote about the first one.
Yeah.
I don't know. We can start with that. My sort of take on it, on a more, I don't know, visionary or poetic level, was about the separation of the spirit of justice from the current shape or form that it takes. This sort of alchemical separation of the body and spirit of justice, and the body or form needing to be remade while the spirit is remembered without, you know, in principle and without context. The idea of like, this is, you know, that some of, should we say, and we could just take a look at this in terms of the justice system in the United States, yes, or whatever. There are a lot, yeah, of fairness is a pretty important human dynamic. So, but it's like, so we have the idea of what's fair, but then how do we structure our relationships personally or collectively to actually enact that principle? And in that Pluto, especially Pluto and Capricorn, very often points to systems which have decayed to the point where they do not accomplish accomplish the purpose for which they were designed. Mm. You have this alchemical sort of needing to let the body die. So, yes, and then, you know, cut it up and reform it the way you do alchemically. And so that the spirit can then inhabit a body which makes sense for it. And I believe I wrote something. I had sort of like a crumbled, broken statue of justice from which the goddess has fled.
Yes. It is interesting. So almost that threat or attack to the concept of justice or integrity or, I mean, I want to say kindness, because I think one of the ideals of Jupiter and Libra is that fairness that is sort of morally and ethically kind.
Absolutely.
And it is making me think of the issue, particularly in the US, if I'm remembering rightly, where Obama was trying to confirm a justice, like a senior court justice, towards the end of his presidency, and I don't think he was able to because of the way the House or the Senate was working or what have you. Mm. And I can't remember how that story unfolded, but that's just, I guess, one little example of this antagonistic energy, really, between the old powers that be, maybe Pluto and Cap, with the ideal of of justice, and how that is being having to be adjusted in this current climate.
Absolutely. Yeah. I on a really like simple level, I think Pluto has the capacity to limit or sabotage what Jupiter in Libra is trying to do. Yes. And that if we maybe go one level deeper, Pluto is saying there actually needs to be a much deeper change here. We can't just, you know, grease it up with a little Jupiter juice. You know, we can't just like throw a little, you know, fairy dust at it. Some deeper repair and rebirth may be necessary in order to get to the Jupiter and Libra ideal.
Yeah. And so for people who are listening at home, I guess, or following on Facebook, the idea of checking into the houses in their charts or in our charts where the Jupiter in Libra transit is happening and the Pluto in Capricorn transit is happening, even if it's not hitting within a few degrees a planet in your chart, that concept you just talked about, Austin, about how we have to dig deeper, we have to go further in maybe to the shadow or the darkness or maybe even our unconscious gunk to try and get this Jupiter in Libra ideal supported in whatever house that's coming through. But the Pluto and Capricorn house is an essential part of the process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That actually, when you say it like that, it makes sense for what's been going on for me and what I've been thinking about.
Okay, cool. Based on how it's showing up in your chart?
Yeah, just thinking about the houses actually makes a ton of sense for me.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Yeah, I feel like, oh, I'm gonna have to think about this later too. It's big, because it's what you sort of spoke to made me think of the idea that it is that deeper. It's like a conceptual or a structural change that's required. You can't just put another thing on top and hope it's okay.
Right,
We've got to dig into the foundation. Like, how did we get here? And then we have to recreate down here before this Jupiter and Libra ideal can be made manifest.
Yep. Yep. All right. I think we did it.
Yeah, we got it. We got it. So to whoever has been waiting since last month, thank you for your patience.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that, so this is sort of completing that. So that's actually something that's probably been taking place or a series of events since late last year when that first square occurred. And then we got the second square a few months ago. And then this is the final one in order to sort of bring that, that process to completion.
Totally. And I'm just thinking too, very quickly, Austin and I obviously are the same generation. And within this time frame, within those degrees, we are part of a generation who have Pluto in Libra between that 15 and 19 degree point. So this Jupiter-Pluto square is actually triggering the larger Pluto square Pluto life cycle or generational transit. So if you are like Austin and I and you were born in the late 70s or you're currently in your late 30s, maybe just on the other side of 40, it may be a little bit more poignant for you because it's tapping into to that. Not everyone is as spring chicken as our dear Chris.
Right. I know I always forget that you guys are in a different Pluto generation than I am, the Pluto and Libra versus the Pluto and Scorpio generation, although I'm starting to see a lot more Pluto and Scorpio astrologers. It's actually kind of surprising. Yes. They're starting to come old. Out of the woodwork.
They're all post, well, not all, but many of them are now post-Saturn return too, with having mm-hmm. Saturn having gone through there.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, no, Kelly and I are different Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto.
To you. Chris.
Well, I actually, I'm one of the unique ones that's still Neptune in Sag.
Oh, yeah. It's like the very end. Yeah,
okay. So we all have that in common.
Right. That's the disco Neptune.
Right.
Because of the deacon, Austin?
No, that's just Neptune in Sag was disco.
Just the disco. So the whole generation. Of course, that makes sense.
It's the 70s Neptune. It's like psychedelics and like bright and loud and cocaine and, you know, it's
Neptune that makes sense. Like,
that's literally what happened, right?
There should be a disco symbol for one of the deacons, though. I agree. I don't know if that's in the Picatrix.
The deacon. No, that's I'm gonna have to think about that.
Yeah, that'll have to be a future project because you did the book where you, you know, brought out all of the ancient symbols for the decans, but maybe it would be a good project to create the modern symbols for the decans at some point in the future.
Well, I did that already.
Yeah, I guess you did do that. All right. Well, you did omit the disco decans, so.
No, it's true. No, I would say,
based on what you know, Austin, which decan in Sag do you think is the most disco?
I think, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, Leo 2 is a pretty good contender for the disco decan. It's the Jupiter ruled decan in Leo.
Yeah.
It's interesting with Sag, with the decans and just Sag in general, because Sag can be so incredibly intense and military and philosophical. You get all of these images of like warriors or people like, having to, you know, tap the very core of their spirit to get through things. But then you also have this super light, fun side of Sag. And most of the traditional symbols, most of the traditional decanic images for Sag are actually really serious. It's like, it's a guy in a chariot with a bow and arrow moving swiftly to war, right? Which, that kind of stuff. And they get more depressing than that. Here's one that's just kind of interesting, but I think very relevant to the period of time where we are. So using the descending order method of determining planetary rulers, which is sort of became the standard in the Western side of astrology, the last decan of Sagittarius is ruled by Saturn. And so Saturn has been there pretty much this whole year and is going to be there the rest of the year. The image for that from the Picatrix is like a man with a golden crown or hat murdering somebody. Which,
such a great image, so evocative.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about leadership issues
that's what I was getting. I mean, and that's a nice segue to come back to the other Jupiter aspect for the month, which is the Jupiter sextile Saturn, while mm-hmm. Saturn is in that decan at the very end of August.
Right. And I do want to mention really quickly that it looks like we're running out of time because we've got 15 minutes left, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So we might want to start nailing some of the rest of whatever we wanted to cover for so that the Saturn sextile to Jupiter, right?
Mm-hmm.
We should talk about that in the Mercury retrograde.
Yeah, the Mercury retrograde is huge to me because it's like right in the middle of the month and it gets so much tied into that whole cluster of stuff happening in late Leo. So I do feel like we should spend a few minutes talking about that.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. This is really a big feature for August.
Okay, so I'm going to share the screen and we see Mercury in Virgo, moving through Virgo in early August, but it's slowing down. It's getting slower and slower because it's getting further and further away from the sun from our vantage point here on Earth, so that eventually by August 12th, August 13th, Mercury stations retrograde at 11 degrees of Virgo, as we've mentioned earlier, and then it starts backing up towards that whole cluster of stuff in Leo, so that by the time the eclipse happens at 28 degrees of Leo around the 21st or so, Mercury is back to 8 degrees of Virgo, and eventually the sun does move into Virgo and then conjoins Mercury. It looks like around August 26th, August 27th at 3 degrees of Virgo. And then what's weird about it is that Mercury gets back to the beginning of Virgo and then makes a retrograde ingress into Leo. So it goes into like 29 Leo. And there it catches up with Mars, who by this point is in late Leo as well. And then eventually we have a conjunction of Mercury and Mars at about 28 degrees of Leo, which is the exact degree that the eclipse took place.
Yes.
And this is pushing us a little bit out of our time frame because this doesn't happen until the very beginning of September. But it's very, very notable because it creates this whole series of different combinations that are taking place around the eclipse and in connection with the eclipse degree, rather than just like a one-time event. We're talking about like a cluster of stuff happening.
Every time you say cluster, Chris, I just want to finish that, but we'll keep it G-rated. But it's true. And that came up in the eclipse panel at the weekend. Demetra and I were commenting on how Mars over, you know, the 10 to 14 days after the eclipse is going to move through and trigger all the hot degrees of the eclipse period. And I actually hadn't factored in the Mercury conjunct the Mars, but this is running right through to about the 4th or 5th of September. And I think we're still in this really hot eclipse period or clustering time frame.
Right. All right. Yeah, so, and that's, you know, Mercury-Mars conjunctions, while they can sometimes be dynamic in a positive way and it can, you know, ease communication or make a person much more free to say something, you know, oftentimes that can be kind of a difficult or traditionally was interpreted as kind of a difficult combination.
I would like to bring up what I believe late June's Mercury-Mars conjunction in Cancer. That was the poop in the pool
moment.
Right. And what's funny is I had someone write me that literally happened, and I had several people write me that something extremely analogically close, something very parallel to that happened. So this is, it's not quite poop in the pool because it's not in Cancer, but.
But it is poop.
Yeah, well, it's definitely some stuff's going to get said. And this is go ahead.
I was just going to say, we don't need any more, speaking without thinking coming into the mix, but that's what this looks, that's what this looks and feels like, because this is a stationing Mercury. This is where Mercury stations direct.
Right. So just a few days later. So when is that? It stations, just a few days later, by September 5th and 6th, Mercury stations at that same degree at 28. So Mercury stations direct on the eclipse degree just after hitting Mars. And that's actually a really good point, Kelly, that there's an impulsiveness oftentimes about communication and sometimes saying something that you shouldn't, or something that if you were in a less heated moment that you wouldn't say, or that you would hold your tongue, but instead sort of, you know, going with that. And that's oftentimes on a purely like psychological level, one of the easiest examples of why a Mercury-Mars conjunction can be problematic or difficult much of the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, we don't need any. I mean, it feels like shooting from the hip, but it's the words that are coming out with that. You know, I always think of Leo. It's like one of the feral signs, or, the last half of Leo is particularly operating from that very primal place where it's not the high analytical intellect of, you know, the Virgo or the Mercury or the air signs. It's more reactive rather than thoughtful and considered. And I think this is just sort of bringing out perhaps, you know, the extreme of that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hitting 28 Leo. And like, what do you do if you're in a situation where you're already somebody who I'm trying to imagine what that even looks like. Like, what if you're already somebody who says things off the cuff like that, and then you have...
Yeah, how do you get more? I mean, do you take up all night tweeting instead of just 3 a.m. tweeting? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're going to find out. I mean, there's worst case scenarios and best case scenarios. Hopefully we're just looking at like the Twitter storm of the century or something like that, rather than, you know, reaching for the nuclear launch codes or something because somebody pissed you off.
That's a more extreme manifestation. Yeah, this is technically early in September, but, you know, by the time we record our next session, we'll be in the thick of this energy. So
sure,
it's good that we've forewarned ourselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, luckily, one of the things that's almost a little positive is that by the time Mercury does station, Mars has moved into Virgo. And I feel like that takes a little bit of the heat off of Leo. So whatever placements are getting hit in late Leo, at least it's like a relatively transitory thing by the time we get to early September. And we've got some, you know, removal of a little bit of the impetus of some of that once Mars moves into Virgo and begins its journey through that sign for however long it is, a month or two.
It'll be in Virgo for about 6 weeks, I think. And until sort of late October. And yeah, it's sort of like a welcome cooling off.
That we're already a week into next month by the time Mars does that.
This is not until like 6-7 September. So
one thing I wanted to say is just in terms of writing, you know, getting through August, I think a lot of people are going to experience it as it's sort of like a slip and slide that, you know, at some time in the beginning of the month, and then it's just gonna go, and you're gonna like wake up in September and be like, that was fucking crazy. Sorry. And that it trying to keep everything under control and to avoid being sidetracked from your perfect plan or schedule is probably not going to be a great strategy. I think, you know, trying to do a good job while you're, you know, being taken along a certain course. You know, it's like, no, I'm going to have this fight with somebody, or this is going to be a thing, but I can at least like try to do a good job of it. Does that make sense? Like try to steer rather than plot the trajectory. If you think about it, you guys ever been in a slip and slide? You kind of like angle.
That's a really good idea. Yeah. You can't plan exactly where it's going to take you, but you can try and, you know, direct the force to a certain extent.
You can avoid getting turned around and doing it backwards, right? Which is going to be even more terrifying and uncomfortable.
Yes. Oh, God. I love your analogies, Austin.
Thanks.
Yeah.
They're what I have. So.
They're brilliant.
So one of the last major things it looks like that happens in August that we should touch on is that we have Saturn stationing direct in Sagittarius, right? So this is actually the final station of Saturn before it basically proceeds to zip out of Sagittarius by the end of the year.
I don't think I've ever imagined Saturn zipping.
Zipping, right.
Before.
Well, I'm just thinking of like the long... Even though it's actually gone really quickly at this point, we're surprisingly already nearly two years into Saturn in Sagittarius. But in terms of the long, you know, for some people, especially for some of those people with natal Saturn in Sagittarius that have been having their Saturn returns over the past couple of years, the sort of long trudge of Saturn through Sagittarius, and now you can sort of see the finish line and you've got about, you know, six months to go. So from that perspective, let's say... jogging or having a nice jaunt through the rest of the sign.
Totally. Yeah, it is. And I think it's that intensification at 21 Sag. So if that happens to be significant for you, then more of that.
Yeah.
But it is going to be, yeah, Saturn will station at 21 and then we're straight into the latter part of Sag, which is repeating territory. Saturn, I think, stationed retrograde at 26 or 27 in March earlier this year, and then into Capricorn right around the solstice, which I think is kind of interesting.
It's very interesting. Also, Mercury stations retrograde right on top of Sag at the very end, right before Saturn ingresses. That's the final chapter of planets in late fire signs in 2017. And obviously, whatever events that signifies will tie very closely into what's happening this month.
Oh, that's a good point. Because of Mercury station at the end of Sag.
Like on top of Saturn, yeah.
Yeah.
Pinging the eclipse degree and, you know, yeah. That stuff.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward, because I loved the Saturn and Sagittarius episode that we did at the very beginning of this, and I want to do another one of those with Saturn and Capricorn with everybody before that gets started. And then I'm also really looking forward to doing some of those interviews with, like, post Saturn and in Saturn return Saturn and Sagittarius people, because there's just been some really literal and really, like, evocative Saturn returns for some of those Saturn and Sag people, especially because most of them in the 80s had that unique conjunction of Saturn conjunct Uranus. And oftentimes, yes. You know, some of their Saturn return stories have been like things that just came out of the blue or things that were unexpected. And it's been really funny and literal in that way oftentimes.
Yes. Being married to someone with one of those configurations, there have been a lot of surprises.
So deadpan.
Yeah, that's one of the consistent themes. And then, of course, this Saturn in Sag itself, I feel, has been really just very literal in terms of the many different ways that that's played out and the things that we talked about when we did that episode. And just a lot of that's been pretty straightforward in terms of the keywords that we sort of anticipated. But to see it play out so in such a straightforward fashion has been really interesting over the past couple of years as well.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that too. I need to figure out a non-terrifying metaphorical framework for Saturn and Pluto in Capricorn. Right. When I was on a podcast not too long ago, Rune Soup, which you were on, and I was talking with the host, Gordon, about that. And Gordon was like, oh, so this is the goat god of death? And I was like, that's hilarious and not wrong, but we can't call it that.
Right.
I like that. It's very true.
Gordon's he's a clever fellow. I've got half a reframe, which is that it's an Indiana Jones and the goat god of death. There's a sort of archaeological into the past adventure that's full of, you know, spooky treasures and crumbling structures and, tomes that are, tombs that are not, you know, not yet entirely quiet. And perhaps at the bottom of that archaeological dig is the goat god of death. And maybe he's not as bad as it sounds. But anyway.
I love that.
In process.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, as soon as you said this digging around, it made me think of Outlander for some reason, because of the historical component, because you guys may not know anything about Outlander. Does this mean anything to either of you?
I've heard of it, but I haven't watched it.
Okay. You guys have the wrong biological equipment to be aware of this series. It is a historical novel series equivalent to Game of Thrones. There are book 9 is about to come out. Each book is about 1,000 pages long. It's set between the 20th century in England and 18th century Scotland, but also 18th century America, so the revolutionary period. And interestingly, because of course the Pluto return that is sort of going on collectively ties in to that time frame now. And this season, these book series have been made into a show that if you ask any of the women in your life, they may be a little more familiar with this. So this is a shout out to our female listeners. Although there's a lot of great history in the books and in the series, so that, you know, if you like historical stuff. But that idea
sounds interesting.
It's really, and there's a bit of time travel. So the way, you know, the main character goes through the standing stones in Scotland from like 1940s or 1950s England and ends up in like 1740 something in Scotland with the Scottish Highlander Rebellion. So it's historically accurate in terms of the rebellion and the kings and the way the story unfolds into book, you know, 4 and 5, we end up with a bit more time travel back and forth, but they end up in Boston. pre-American Revolution. So that's interesting too. But all of what you're saying there, Austin, about that mining the past and the archaeological piece, it's going to be fascinating how we see that come through in arts and culture, in addition to what we might be, you know, dealing with goat gods and et cetera in the mainstream.
Yeah, and maybe it's digging our way out of the past that we're buried under, you know, 20th century. There's a lot of rubble from the 20th century.
But yes.
Outlander sounds really interesting. Kate and I are always looking for good shows.
Oh my gosh, totally.
And there's always, you know.
It's on Netflix too. Seasons 1 and 2 are on Netflix. They're on Netflix in Canada, so I can't imagine why they wouldn't be on Netflix in the US.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I mean, we get one Game of Thrones episode a week, so.
Yeah, because it's coming through real time right now because the new season's out for Game of Thrones.
I would also say almost guaranteed that the that whatever's going on in Game of Thrones is going to, whatever episode comes out around the eclipse is totally going to look like a solar eclipse, right?
Yeah.
Like Game of Thrones has lined up with a lot of astrology. As anything that really represents the zeitgeist does accidentally. Also, probably one of the biggest fights, most promoted fights in years, in decades, Conor McGregor versus Floyd Mayweather is right after the solar eclipse. It's the most hyped thing ever. And people are criticizing it for being overhyped, but they're still talking about it constantly in public. It's for anybody who's interested in combat sports, it's a huge thing, either to love or to hate. And it will be it's a huge thing, and it makes perfect sense that it's arriving with right after the Leo eclipse.
I mean, and that's a good example of something where for one person, it's going to be, you know, a huge defeat. And for the other person, it's going to be a huge victory, and how people can sometimes have those two extremes when it comes to eclipses, depending on how it's sort of hitting their chart. But either way, it ends up being a huge turning point in their life one way or another.
Right. If you have somebody who has an enemy and that conflict is decided in favor of one or another under the same configuration, that's a victory story for one person and a crushing defeat. Like, you don't get martial victory without martial defeat.
Yeah.
Because there's a contest. So we can't say that one configuration in general will mean only defeat stories or only victory stories if Mars is involved. Like, there are Jupiterian victories where everybody wins.
Yeah. Right? This eclipse is not that.
No, I don't expect it to be.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, this is an eclipse that takes place with Mars in such close proximity that becomes one of the main things really coloring it in many ways.
In a Mars ruled decan.
The contest.
Right.
Yeah. And I had seen an argument on Facebook about Mars having potentially more dignity at this part of Leo. I didn't necessarily agree with the argument, but that Mars has a bit of strength, I guess.
Mars will be involved, right? I think it's fair.
Mars turns at the very end. Yeah,
we should be factoring, especially with Mercury coming back to meet up with Mars on the degree of the eclipse, right? Emphasizing Mars yet again. Yeah, there's actually, let me see if I can get it. There's kind of a hilarious Mars Decan 3 image from, I think it's the Yavanajataka image. That also speaks to issues of rulership and kingship. Let me just throw that out there. Do, 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 do. Okay, well, this is interesting. So there's some of it that's irrelevant, but it's a woman whose actions are marvelous and who's cunning in respect to machines and to undertakings involving the arts, businesses, or jewels. Here's the part that pinged me about this. We're talking about Game of Thrones. Seated on an ivory throne, she considers the murder of her enemies.
Wow.
That's the Decan for late Leo?
Leo 3 from the Yavanajataka. I believe that's the Pingree translation.
Nice.
That's Cersei, right? Seated on a throne, she considers the murder of her enemies.
Have we what?
I don't know if she is cunning in respect to machines, but actually that's fair.
Have you guys read the books? Like, is the TV series, because I read all the books of Game of Thrones because I'm a massive book nerd. Mm-hmm. Is the TV series sticking quite closely to the books?
Mostly it is beyond it now.
Yeah. I mean, they're you could not
you could not have read what is about what has been happening.
Okay, got it. Got
yeah, because he's not getting the books out.
He's very slow.
Right. But they're starting to like merge some timelines. So it's like some of the main points are there, but they're taking like what were two different stories and like condensing them into one or shortening things because they've only got like 10 or 13 episodes left.
Same thing's happening in Outlander. Diana Gabaldon, the Outlander author, and George R. R. Martin are very good friends in real life. And yeah, same thing where they have to condense or they're keeping the key pivot points in the story, but obviously they can't put it all into like 1,000 pages or whatever into 13 episodes.
So we should go probably, but sure. what I would say that they excised from the books, Kelly, in the show is the gratuitous descriptions of food.
Ah.
There are no longer paragraphs worth of text about the flavor and texture of Dornish peppers.
George R. R. Martin is pretty wordy when it comes to that.
Yeah, a friend of mine made the joke, sort of half believes that the character of Hot Pie is George Martin inserting himself into the story. Because Hot Pie is just like, oh, let me tell you about exactly how I made the crust for this. And it's the only place where you see that food detail.
Oh my gosh.
It's a little mean maybe, but I'm not sure it's entirely wrong.
It's probably not. Oh, this has been great, guys.
Yeah.
This is a lot of fun. So this is our second live stream. So this is working out relatively well. And I think we'll continue doing this and making this a regular thing from now on. So we streamed it through my private Facebook page, but I'm still toying with that to see what the best setup is so that people can subscribe and follow us in the future. Of course, if you want future announcements about the show, you should subscribe to the podcast at theastrologypodcast.com /subscribe. And patrons of the show, of course, always get a heads up and also get a private link to join us in the Zoom webinar when we're doing these episodes live rather than just in Facebook. Yeah, so I think we'll do this again next month.
Which is like a pre-show ticket too, right? Yeah. That link is... to the pre-show chat, which we can't guarantee what will be part of it, but you will get it.
Yeah, you get to see us scrambling ahead of time to get it together and get ready to do the episode. So I guess we'll do this again next month, and we'll basically do the next episode right after or not too long after the eclipse. So hopefully whatever that was about is over and we have something interesting to talk about. Well, I'm sure we'll have something interesting to talk about, but... we'll see what that is.
Jupiter speaker for September. We can talk about that.
Yeah, that would be nice. Also, but to be fair, according to traditional texts, solar eclipses get 6 months to deliver what they have promised.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's going to be playing out over some time. And then, of course, we have the fact that it's a series of eclipses that will keep taking place in Leo and Aquarius for even longer than that. So... we are buckling in and we're ready for quite the ride over the next, year or so.
Totally.
All right, cool.
Strap in.
Well, thanks everyone for joining me today. Thanks to everyone following the live stream on Facebook. If you enjoyed this, let us know and we'll keep doing it in the future. If you're a fan of the podcast, always consider becoming a patron of the show because we do one episode each week. And it's basically the way I have this structured at this point is it's like attending a local astrology lecture where normally, you know, you would pay like $10 to attend a lecture from a famous astrologer and hear them present some topic. And basically that's what I'm doing with the podcast at this point. And there are patrons of the show who pay $1 or $5 or $10 just voluntarily in order to support this work. And then I try to take some of that money and invest it in buying microphones for the guests or sending out headphones and other stuff like that to continue to improve and expand what we're doing with the show. So consider becoming a patron. If you're listening to us through iTunes, then consider giving us a good rating on iTunes since that'll help other people to find the show. And definitely check out the websites of Austin and Kelly and myself for more information about our consultations and classes and other things that we're offering in the field of astrology. So Austin, your website is austinkopic.com and Kelly, yours is kellysastrology.com, right?
Yes.
Perfect. And you can find out more information about me at chrisbrennanastrologer.com. So I think that's it for today. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.